From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is running for re-election while still under indictment. Why hasn't the Paxton case gone to trial? A Texas woman paints a homemade political sign, plants it in her front yard, then the police came and took it. Now her story has gone viral. And the writings of North American indigenous authors, why they matter. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton announced that he was running for re-election, he highlighted many of his accomplishments from his years in office. That would include fighting Washington, D.C.'s overreach, suing the federal government to end Obamacare's protection for pre-existing conditions, suing Texas sanctuary cities, protecting gun rights, and being a staunch defender of the pro-life movement.
I'm not afraid to stand my ground and fight for what's right. That's why I'm announcing for re-election as Attorney General. Much has been accomplished, but I'm just getting started, and there's more to be done. This campaign will be focused on grassroots support because that's where our democracy works best. With your help, we will continue to fight for conservative principles. I hope you'll get involved and join our team today. Thank you, and may God bless the great state of Texas.
But what Paxton didn't mention in his campaign announcement is that he remains under indictment on three felony charges. The indictments came in July 2015, and since then the case has been fraught with legal challenges and maneuvers slowing the process every step of the way. Paxton continues to say he is innocent of the white-collar criminal allegations, and he calls the grand jury indictment a witch hunt initiated by his political enemies. Despite the criminal charges, there appears to be no visible cracks in Paxton's Republican base. He faced no challenger in the Republican primary for attorney general. Texas Observer staff writer Michael Barajas has been covering the saga and explores why Paxton's case lingers in legal limbo.
Ken Paxton, he's been indicted and awaiting trial for, it's three felony charges, two counts of securities fraud, and another for failing to register with the state as an investment advisor, basically. These are like just these sort of convoluted looking business deals that it appears, you know, a lot of people in political power, state representatives and legislative members, you know, it seems like especially kind of get into these business deals with all these twists and turns. And I mean, that's one thing that's sort of been exposed by a lot of this. As far as failing to register as an investment advisor, the one that, you know, according to most of the folks that I talk to, even, you know, sort of quietly Republicans, that's the one that has them the most worried because it's one that he's effectively already admitted to. I mean, this came up. What's kind of remarkable about this, you know, these charges is that they came up during the primary race, you know, where we saw a lot of sort of, you know, we saw the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party in Texas really sort of flex its muscle and was able to get, you know, somebody like Ken Paxton through a primary when he was, you know, facing, you know, some pretty sort of like well-known establishment Republicans who were actually kind of waving this stuff in voters' faces all the way back then.
Why hasn't Ken Paxton gone to trial since he was indicted, and he was indicted not long after he was elected?
Yeah, so it's really a mix of sort of political wrangling and legal wrangling, actually. You know, a lot has been said about how Ken Paxton was able to raise like this sort of large legal defense fund in the first place. He's hired some like pretty big gun, white collar criminal defense attorneys to do all the usual things you would expect somebody in his position to do, which is file, you know, a whole bunch of appeals up and down all the way to the, you know, highest criminal court and back. And on the substance of the charges, you know, a judge hasn't thrown them out and an appeals court hasn't thrown them out. So as far as that's concerned, I mean, really, it's like the parties are waiting for trial. But Ken Paxton's supporters have engaged in this other sort of side legal battle where they've essentially said, you know, the independent prosecutors, the private sector, you know, lawyers that we appointed to handle this case, they shouldn't be making this much money. and we're going to, you know, fight tooth and nail to make sure they, you know, essentially don't get paid. And they convinced the eventually the Collin County, you know, Commissioner's Court up there, which is Republican, to wage that legal fight for them.
The Paxton campaign is saying that they are not the ones who are dragging their feet on this 3 years.
Yeah.
They're saying that it's just the way things work. Paxton says he wants a quick trial, but this is the legal process is slow.
Yeah. I mean, the legal process can move slowly. It's working pretty slowly in this case for such a high profile case. Prosecutors lay this out. I mean, at least they lay their perspective out on this pretty clearly in all of the legal filings. They gave this sort of collective group of Paxton supporters a name. They called them Team Paxton and said they embarked on like a very clearly calculated kind of like crusade to taint the Collin County jury pool, which is why the case eventually got moved to Houston. Now there's that whole thing. I mean, when you have that kind of resistance, you know, these cases will take a long time. They found on the prosecutor pay matter something that I guess the courts are willing to bite at least one appeals court in Texas, and now we're sort of just waiting on the Court of Criminal Appeals, which has also taken a very long time to figure out what it thinks on this. I mean, they've had it'll be coming up on a year, I think, in December. They've had this sort of matter sitting before them, and they haven't said anything. And it's unlikely, according to the legal experts I speak to, that they would do anything so close before an election.
So questions that people, I think, want to know is, did Ken Paxton, Attorney General, when he was accused, indicted, and then went through the process, has he received favors, special treatment? Because he's Attorney General and because he's a high-ranking Republican.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about special favors. I mean, I think this just shows you what happens to the criminal justice system when you throw a lot of money at it. The narrative that's been spun around his case from the sort of extreme other side, if you want to think of it that way, which is the you know, that he's been politically persecuted. This prosecution is nothing but politics. It's just his like detractors going after him, and look at how they've twisted the system to get this good man sort of in legal limbo for all of these years for trumped up charges.
Meanwhile, Attorney General Ken Paxton is running for re-election. What does he say when he goes before voters on the campaign stump?
That is a really good question. I was not able to, of course, interview him for my story. You'd be hard pressed to find him doing any sort of public campaign forum, rally, anything that, you know, people who do not already support him, you know, are able to go to. He kind of did this when he ran for attorney general the first time, you know, after he won the primary, a pretty bruising primary, you know, when a lot of this stuff again came up. He, you know, put his head down. He ran in Texas. Beat a Democrat named Sam Houston by a huge degree. So I think he's hoping by just sort of keeping his head down again, maybe this stuff won't connect with voters, or they won't get down into the weeds of it, or they'll think the charges just went away. That's a lot of people seem to think the charges just went away. So
and some people think that because this has taken so long that he must be not guilty.
Well, there's some clear, I mean, there's clear political incentive to delay this as long as he has. I mean, they're going to deny that they did that. They wouldn't say that to me even, but I mean, I've heard them say that elsewhere. I've seen them say that elsewhere.
What should voters know about this case and these charges about Ken Paxton? They should know that they are legitimate, yes or no, and that he still has to have his day in court, right?
Yeah, these charges have not been thrown out. You know, despite numerous attempts to appeal them, numerous courts have determined that, you know, best setting for them is to air out at a trial. They have not come to any sort of agreement or settlement with prosecutors that were appointed to litigate this case on behalf of, you know, the people of Texas. So, you know, yeah, the trial would be the next stage for this. And he's, you know, him and his supporters have successfully delayed that.
Do you think that they want to avoid a trial because, one, it would look bad, and two, it would force the release of information that would also look bad?
I think that's the obvious implication of all of this. That's certainly what a lot of people concluded.
So what happens now? Elections?
The elections. Yeah. Justin Nelson has, among other things, been trying to make this a pretty big part of his campaign.
That's the Democrat?
Unseat. Yeah, the Democrat who's hoping to unseat Ken Paxton. I spoke to him pretty extensively about these charges. I mean, one of the things that he told me that I thought was pretty interesting was that he himself has had to sort of educate voters on this as well, that he has a lot of people that got the same reaction that I got whenever I would tell people about this story, is that, oh, those didn't go away, or he hasn't gotten to those. That's not done yet. It's been years. So, yeah, on the campaign, I think, is facing that as well.
Michael Barajas is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. His latest article is about the three indictments facing Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. It's titled, Stand By Your Man, How the Collin County GOP Derailed Ken Paxton's Prosecution and Turned Him into a Right-Wing Hero. When a homemade political sign caught the attention of Texas Agricultural Commissioner Sid Miller, the sign was seized by the local police and the story went viral. It happened in Hamilton, a town in central Texas, west of Waco. Police there confiscated the sign painted by resident Marion Stanford, who said she made it after watching the latest political storm in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I was watching the Kavanaugh hearings. I wasn't happy with Judge Kavanaugh. I made the sign out of materials that I had on hand, and I borrowed the image from Ann Telnay's, a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist. And the original cartoon was published in the Washington Post in 2017 in December.
And what did that look like?
It was basically the same thing, except it was all red, white, and blue. There was no pink, there was no blonde, and there was no help.
But it's an elephant with its trunk going up a girl's skirt.
Well, yes, but really, I could say, anybody could say, it's an elephant with his trunk at the hip, at the hem of the skirt, because, you know, who's to say otherwise?
Okay.
But
so you saw that in the Washington Post. You saw the Kavanaugh. You were inspired, and you made a sign.
Well, I'm inspired. I was angry. I was angry. I thought, how in the world is this man qualified for the Supreme Court? He can't even conduct himself as a gentleman at a hearing. At a hearing that's going to determine if he's going to sit on the Supreme Court. So he must have just figured it's a given and he can behave himself any way he cares to. So, yes, I was not happy.
So you put the sign in the front yard. What happened?
Nothing happened for several days. I put it in the yard right after I finished painting it, right after the hearing. So it was there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Tuesday is when it was taken down, taken away. Tuesday is when it was brought to my attention about, Sid Miller's post.
The Commissioner of Agriculture in Texas.
Right. He stated that it was Judge Kavanaugh's daughter. And it just snowballed from there. You know, his supporters just started putting all kinds of things on that thread. Pornography, I'm a child abuser, I should be arrested. Truthfully, I quit reading after a while because I put it off to Sid's idiot army. You can look at the picture. That's all you'd have to do. You can look at the picture. And he had the picture posted when he made the declaration that it was Judge Kavanaugh's daughter. You can look at that, and any thinking person, marginally intelligent, will go, well, it looks like a stick figure to me, maybe a colored, you know, color it in stick figure, but doesn't look like any human I've ever seen. So anyway.
So you think Sid Miller manufactured false outrage, snowflake act, in order to drum up supporters and target you for speaking out?
I think so.
So who took the sign? Where did the sign go?
Well, I have the sign back now.
But wasn't it the Hamilton police came knocking on your door?
Well, nobody comes knocking on my door because I have dogs. A couple of the dogs started barking, so I knew somebody was outside. I went to the door, and I saw the police car. And I have to tell you, I mean, there was no stormtrooper. There was no ugliness. There was a discussion. His assertion that it was pornography and didn't belong in the front yard, but he was, it was just Sid Miller kind of stuff that he was saying to me. And I was saying the original drawing was done by a Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist, the Washington Post. It was published. And, you know, this kind of stuff, this is the old news because everybody in the world has heard this. So he gives me the choice. He says it has to come down. Either I can take it down or you can take it down. But if it doesn't come down, you'll be arrested. So obviously, I'm not going to jail. I have animals to take care of. I have a job to work. So I figured I'll let him take it. I said, you take it, and I deal with it later, the next day.
So the Hamilton police chief put out a statement detailing what happened. And in his description, it made it seem like that you were not bothered at all by surrendering the sign, that you gave it up willingly.
I gave it up because if I didn't give it up, I'd be arrested. That's not what I'd call willingly. That I wasn't bothered by it, I'm not going to throw a fit about it, and I deal with it the next day. I mean, maybe if I was back in my 30s or even my 40s, I'd throw a fit, and you'd probably hear me all the way down in San Antonio. But I'm a lot more mellow now. When I know I can take care of a problem later, as opposed to throwing a fit now, I'll do it.
You have gotten the sign back?
Yes, I got it back today.
What led to that?
Well, you know, this thing has snowballed unbelievably. And no one's more surprised than me, and I'm sure everybody else involved in it as well is surprised that it's nationwide, it's over in the UK.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think this took on such, grew legs, as we say in the media?
The Me Too movement, the Kavanaugh hearings, that's what motivated the sign to begin with, because women, this generation, this wonderful generation of women are not going to be victimized. They are not going to be silenced. They are not going to sit down and take it anymore. As I've told so many people who contact me, you know, I love your sign, yada, 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 you're so brave. No, none of that. What people see in me, they have in themselves. They do. Every single person who admires me has the very same qualities and the very same opportunities to do the same, and they need to do the same. And I think that sign and this incident and the publicity that it's getting is validating our anger, our right to speak up. And I think that's why it took off.
And you have the sign back now. How did that come?
I did.
Is it no longer pornography? Why would they give it back to you?
Well, because I think very quickly they realized that it wasn't pornography, that it was the wrong thing to do. The city councilman called me. I told Jim, I have no problems. I have no animosity. I mean, I do need the sign back because I've promised it to that group, Maine People's Alliance. So I'm thinking that we'll put it on eBay and whatever it gets, the money will go to their organization.
They're raising money for someone to oppose Susan Collins.
Right. So, you know, I figured, well, they'd be a good one to invest with.
Any more signs? You're going to be painting more? You got other outrage to funnel?
You would not believe people send me that, you know, are sending me pictures of their artwork. And I tell them, hey, fantastic, you know. Put it on a board, put it outside. And I have a couple of ideas, but I don't know. It would almost seem redundant. And to tell you the truth, David, and this is just going to seem so strange, I fancy myself a writer. I'm obviously not a painter. This, I think, will be my opportunity to write an article, and it's about the sign, but this story has so many tentacles. I mean, I'm an animal rights activist. I ran a sanctuary for over a decade. I still provide funding for free spay neuter for pets belonging to low income owners. And had it not been for the experiences that I've had here in Hamilton for over a decade with animal welfare, I wouldn't have the skin to have weathered this phenomena. it would have done me in. It really would have, because it's like a roller coaster ride. It's like an out-of-body experience. So, you know, I'll see, come November, I'll see if the message got out in Texas. I'll see if Sid Miller is reelected. And that he has a base. It's the same base as Trump. Those folks are not going to change their mind no matter what. But there are independents out there that you can reason with. You can reason with them.
Marion Stanford is a resident of Hamilton, Texas. After a political sign she painted was taken by local police, her story went viral. This week, many states, but not Texas, opted to observe Indigenous Peoples Day rather than celebrate Columbus Day. They say America, after all, was not discovered, but the story of Columbus, however, was invented. Taking a day to recognize the sacrifices and contributions of Indigenous people also means celebrating their stories. In this commentary, contributor to Texas Public Radio, Yvette Benavides, offers her review of the book, Why Indigenous Literature Matters, by Daniel Heath Justice.
Recent years have seen the ongoing debate about Indigenous writing and the writing of people of color and our agency to tell our own stories. At the heart of the contention is the question, who gets to tell these stories? American literature includes white authors laying claim to the voices in a deep-rooted power struggle, the vestiges of which can't seem to be avoided even today. But while the inequality born of power structures that seem to have been emboldened and fortified lately linger, there have been small but important gains made by people of color and Indigenous writers striving to tell their own story. Daniel Heath Justice has told a lot of these stories through his fiction. The Colorado-born Canadian citizen of the Cherokee Nation now takes on the yeoman's toil of responding to other concomitant vexing questions about that agency with his latest work, Why Indigenous Literatures Matter. This is no simple feat, of course, as there are more than 600 First Nations in Canada alone, where Justice now lives, works, and teaches. For the unfamiliar, Justice defines a number of terms in his thoughtful and thorough introduction. Among these are the concepts of Indigenous, settler, and settler colonist, which he distinguishes from the concept of colonialism, wherein invaders claim resources but return home rather than creating a new social order that thrives on oppression and displacement of Indigenous peoples. This is part of our history most would like to hide and ignore, even while Indigenous writers continue to teach, write, and publish their own stories about the ways these injustices have affected them. The settler colonist reality means not just an oppressive regime taking over. Indeed, it means the eradication of the Indigenous languages, art, and spirituality. These are necessary accoutrements for our understanding of who we are and where we fit in the world. It makes owning our own storytelling a political act, an act of defiance in some cases, and also an act of survival. In the United States, the last decade has seen glimmers of this eradication and silencing in such states as Arizona, which sought to remove ethnic studies from the curriculum. A judge found that racism was behind that push and struck down that portion of the law in 2017. Closer to home, this past summer here in Texas, the Texas State Board of Education voted to change the name Mexican American Studies to Ethnic Studies, thereby erasing the term Mexican. Justice tackles the truths and the stereotypes about Indigenous peoples in his book, while he allows that well-documented stories and statistics about mental illness, suicide, addiction, and other responses to the historical traumas they've endured, he wants to promote a fuller picture of the Indigenous people. He writes that the stories, quote, don't hide the traumas or the shadows. They don't make everything neat and tidy or assume that the horrors of colonialism will be easily put to rest. But, he adds, our literatures remind us that our histories are more than tragedy, more than suffering, more than the stories of degradation and deficiency that settler colonialism would have us believe. Justice also writes about identity insecurities experienced by those who are raised outside of communities, have light-skinned privilege, are monolingual English speakers. In his book, he says he's intentional about balancing the, quote, spirit of inclusivity with the recognition of healthy, ethical, and necessary boundaries. He chooses to draw broadly on the work of writers from a wide range of voices because of these ever-shifting or problematic identity claims. Justice takes an even broader view of inclusion, too, in order to remedy the prevailing myopia of the reading public. He discusses the tendency of Western literature toward a realism that diminishes the importance of fantasy and surrealism, works dubbed as pulp or escapism and not worthy of merit. He suggests a wider canon, one that includes Indigenous writers but also includes other works heretofore rejected in the literary canon. He also explores personhood, highlighting the work of queer writers. This volume includes an appendix titled A Year of Honoring Indigenous Writers. It's an impressive list, long and varied. It started as a response to someone on Twitter who perceived a lack of Indigenous literature. Each day of 2016, Justice tweeted the names of Indigenous writers, past and present, to, quote, push back against those frequent assumptions that the literary history is any less complex, robust, or diverse than that of other peoples. Ultimately, Justice answers the questions around why we should celebrate Indigenous literatures. Why do they matter, he asks, and answers. Indigenous literatures matter because Indigenous people matter, and we must do all we can, at long last, to put the world back in balance.
Yvette Benavides is a professor of creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. She reviewed the book Why Indigenous Literature Matters by Daniel Heath Justice. It's published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can download the shows wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.